Yeah, actually, I mean, I do thank the seminar, the coordinators for giving me such an infinitely long slot. But I think it's sensible to organize it so that the first part is a normal talk with slides and everything, it'll just be a review of at least where I think things are and what the next steps are, and then we can have the break. And anyone who's interested in discussing, everything in the second part after the break will be about things that are not in the literature. Here, everything is in the literature. Everything after the break will be many things in progress. So anyone who's interested in informal discussions about that will be on the blackboard. So please feel no obligation whatsoever to come, of course. And similarly, feel no reservation about leaving at any point. Okay, what happened to my little pointer here? Oh, there it is. Okay, so, and I should say, there's a long list of my collaborators in this business, some of them who are here. And I guess in the discussion after the break, I might also talk about some work in progress with Mark and Nasir as well. Okay, so I don't want to spend too long on the motivations, but I do want to say a little bit about it. These are at least my motivations. They're certainly not shared by everyone in the field, sort of not remotely, maybe by nobody, but certainly they were very important for me, and so I just want to spend a few minutes telling you about them. And of course, the motivations involve many very wild hopes, and so I will tell you these many wild hopes. The many wild hopes may all be wrong, but they've certainly helped so far to get me out of bed in the morning in a deep and troubling world, in a deeply troubled world. It's not deep, unfortunately. It's just deeply troubled. At least I think this point of view has been useful, at least in our direction of the progress to pushing forward. And anyway, it's not so bad to have wild hopes. You could do worse. So this is why most amplitude talks do not begin with this discussion, but I want to spend 10 minutes talking about it. To me, the motivation behind the subject, certainly the reason I got into it, was the slogan that everybody knows, that because of gravity and quantum mechanics, space-time is doomed. And the sharp version of that statement, much more so than something going wrong near the Planck length at short distances associated with the old problems of renormalizability and so on, is the deeper statement that there's no local observables in gravity. That means the only observables in gravity live on boundaries, and so in this fundamental sense, inside of the space-time doesn't exist at all. And we all know ADS-EFT is a wonderful gateway drug into this idea of emergent space-time. But it's a gateway drug because it doesn't force you to give everything up at once. You find a duality between two systems that at least have normal names. They're both quantum mechanical systems. They're both systems that are described with redundancies that we know and love. Gauge redundancies on one side, diff redundancies on the other side. And so at least it becomes possible to enter this world of emergent space-time without giving everything up at once. And you also all know that in every grand poobah giving summary talks about the state of the field, it says that at some point we have to understand emergent time, we have to go further, et cetera, et cetera. But you can say that as much as you want without having a concrete strategy for how to do it. And I think asking the question about trying to understand scattering amplitudes in a way that doesn't put in the space-time, and really also, surprisingly to me a little bit, it doesn't even have unitarity in it, playing any obviously fundamental role. Finding some way of getting to the answers without putting in those two pillars of 20th century physics in your thinking from the get-go is going to teach us something. It's telling us that it's possible to talk about local unitary physics in a way that does not make those principles manifest. And that has to teach us something. There's an incredible trick that's being played by any mathematical structure that allows us to do that. And I find it very hard to believe that trick won't be relevant to the real situation when we have gravity, where at least the space-time ceases to make sense. And perhaps in cosmological situations, certainly not in anything other than cosmology, but certainly in cosmology, we have reason to at least worry about whether standard quantum mechanical rules make sense because of all the usual confusions about observables and so on and so forth. Now, there is a precedent for this, which if any of you have seen me talk before, you'll be getting sick of this analogy by now. But I love this analogy. Because, of course, it's happened to us previously in physics where we had to give up massively cherished principles that seemed hardwired into the way the world worked. It happened when we went from classical to quantum. So again, if you've heard a talk by me before, you'll have heard this little parable, but I'll say it again. Imagine that that you're a classical physicist in the year 1790, and you're visited by a ghost of theorist future, who wakes you up in the middle of the night and says, "I have news for you from the 1930s. Determinism is gone." And then they disappear off into the night. Okay? So what do you do with that information if you're this classical physicist? Clearly, this is important. It should shake up the way you think about physics. Now, there's an obviously dumb thing you can do. You can say, "I know, I'll add stochastic terms to Newton's laws. That's what I'll do. I have this great head start on other people. You know, my papers will be famous. There'll be stochastic terms to Newton's laws." And that's a completely idiot thing to do. Okay. Well, people do the analogs of that today in other parts of thinking about quantum gravity, but we won't talk about them here. But that's clearly an idiot thing to do. But the point is, it's very hard if you're losing something so fundamental to expect that you can make the big leap to guess the right answer by modifying what you have already. But it's much more reasonable to take another attitude. Say, okay, this is deeply disturbing. Determinism is gone somehow. That's what I was told. That must mean it's not there fundamentally. It's hardwired into Newton's laws, but it's not there fundamentally. Given that it's not there fundamentally, there must be some other way of talking about Newton's laws. Forget about modifying stuff. Forget about actually guessing the correct quantum rules. It's just the very existence, the knowledge that you have to lose this principle, tells you to search, cast around and search for another way of talking about the good old-fashioned physics you have right now that doesn't make that concept so fundamental. Because it's not really there. And if there's any kind of deformation of the theory you have to the correct one, it's not likely to take something hardwired and immediately lose it. Okay? Now, of course, in this case, that principle exists. It's the least action formulation of classical mechanics. In fact, there's so many nice analogies between the amplitude business now and the development of the principle of least action. People were spurred to thinking about the principle of least action because doing calculations with Newton's laws were really hard for celestial mechanics problems. Okay? Of course, this formulation not only made it easier to solve problems, but it had this remarkable feature that it was not manifestly deterministic. Okay? The determinism of the answer is an output of the rules, an output of how you choose to do the variations, the sorts of Lagrangians you consider, and so on. It's not manifestly deterministic. And people back then did wonder why this other formulation existed, why these teleological formulations existed, a word I learned yesterday. But we now know why it exists. It exists because the world is quantum mechanical. And the h-bar goes to zero limit of quantum mechanics is not Newton's laws. The h-bar goes to zero limit of quantum mechanics is the principle of least action. So given that physics doesn't change discontinuously, if there is some concept that we know we have to lose eventually, one way to explore it is to think about phenomenon where the issues are there at order one. You know, for our case today, it's space-time is on the chopping block, so it's what happens at the Big Bang, singularities, et cetera, et cetera. So clearly those are, obviously, the issues are important there. But there's another basic strategy, which is to try to figure out some way of talking about the good old-fashioned physics we know and love in a way that doesn't hardwire in the concept that we know we've got to lose. And so that would be step one. Step one was to reformulate. And if this ideology is true, this is wild hope one, which I'll come back to. But if this general ideology is true, there must be some way of talking about any quantum field theory in any number of dimensions in a way that does not hardwire in space-time. Okay? If the ideology is true. So step one would be to find that reformulation. And perhaps once we found it, there would be a step two, that it suggests a natural deformation. Okay? In a sense, you've done 99% of the work to figure out how to talk about, honestly, perfectly local physics in a way that doesn't hardwire in locality. From that vantage point, there might be a natural suggestion for how to deform away from it so that it's really honestly gone. And that deformation would correspond to adding gravity. okay? And adding gravity in such a way that removes locality, you know, does what it does. Just as you might have imagined that even if experiment had not intervened, people thinking about the principle of least action for 100 years would have eventually thought of quantum mechanics as an interesting deformation of classical physics. And I've looked at this history a little bit, and Hamilton was surprisingly close. Hamilton was really surprisingly close to doing this kind of thing. All right, so that's the highfalutin, one set of highfalutin motivations. Of course, the main motivation most people work on this subject is that Feynman diagrams are horrendously complicated, and the answers end up being horrendously simple and having all these beautiful symmetries, at least in these approximations that we like. And something that makes these wild hopes more reasonable to me is that these highfalutin motivations I just mentioned and the very practical motivations line up perfectly with each other. Okay? Why are Feynman diagrams so complicated? It's not some funny technicality. It's because they're making completely manifest, term by term, locality and unitarity. That's the quantum field theory in quantum field theory are those two principles. And that's what Feynman diagrams do. Okay? So the fact that we seem to be finding ways of getting the answer, the fact that these principles are obscuring the structure of the answer, is a practical hint in the same direction. It's a good idea. It pays to think about the physics in a way that's not so space-time centered. And as I say, it looks to me like unitarity and locality are playing a very symmetrical role. It's at least a change in my own viewpoint, at least at the level of these wild hopes. It looks like its locality and unitarity are sort of complementary aspects of the same thing. And the emergence of locality and unitarity are sort of closely tied to each other. Okay. And of course, the other wonderful thing about this business is that it's all been sitting under our noses for all this time. This is not a situation where the magic is because of some whiz-bang new experiment with extreme precision, measuring some frontier region we'd never seen before, and something new turns up. This is understanding incredible structures that are lying buried in good old-fashioned physics that we know for a fact describes the world sitting under our noses for all this time. In principle, dual conformal invariance could have been discovered in 1955 as a symmetry of classical Yang-Mills theory. It's there. If you know where to look, it's there. It wasn't discovered until 2007. And I think the other incredible thing to me is that it combines so many good ideas. Of course, the ideas from ADS-CFT, twister theory, integrable systems, and something that I find really remarkable, all sorts of wonderful new structures in algebraic geometry that seem to be lying at the heart of this physics, some of which seem to be new to the algebraic geometers. So this is not a situation where we're purely borrowing. This is going to teach the algebraic geometer something. If you come back after the break, I'll tell you something about that story. Okay. So I think I'm done with the motivations. Just the final couple of statements. So of course, you all know that the symmetries of n equals 4 super Yang-Mills on the planar limit generate the Yangian algebra. It's infinite dimensional symmetry, completely invisible in the Lagrangian. And it's, of course, amazing these Yangians show up in other places in physics. Of course, they show up in the Heisenberg spin chain. If you solve the Heisenberg spin chain as an undergraduate, the reason you can solve it is because it's integrable. And the infinite dimensional symmetry it has is the Yangian of SU2. It's incredible that n equals 4 super Yang-Mills has a Yangian of something that's not so far from that. It's SL4/4. It's got some extra variables and some extra fermionic directions, but it's just stunning that these structures seem to have anything to do with each other. And of course, I think, and many of us think, that the whole story that's going on with amplitudes now is just the next natural step after the really spectacular breakthroughs of the last decade in completely solving for the spectrum of anomalous dimensions in n equals 4. Super Yang-Mills. Again, you know, this is a situation where the style of the solution perfectly exemplifies the kind of general philosophy we're talking about. You write down a bunch of integral equations. They don't look anything like string theory on the strongly coupled end. They don't look anything like Feynman diagrams on the weakly coupled end. You just solve them. They give you an expansion on one end that happens to reproduce Feynman diagrams. You give you an expansion on the other end that happens to reproduce what you get from solving the string theory at the other end. But it's not either thing. It's some third thing in between. And it's a completely spectacular structure. Despite the fact that it's in principle solved, it would be incredible to understand the structure in a way that you could explain to your grandmother. Or give, if not a very motivated grandmother even, okay? Hey, heck, for that matter to me, okay? And it just seems that the scattering amplitudes are the next most complicated observables in these theories. Instead of depending on one meager variable, the TUF coupling, they have this rich dependence on external kinematics. They're slightly more physical, and by physical here I mean simply the theory isn't Euclidean. It's actually a Lorentzian process. So unitarity is also important. And so we expect a richer structure, but it should echo a lot of what we've seen already, and indeed it is. So the sort of summary wild hope, which I said already, is that there is a new formulation of field theory that exists for the deep highfalutin reasons. It should be there for completely generically, any theory in any number of dimensions. Of course, we don't know what it is, so we're searching for it. Obviously, we're going to search for it in the simplest cases first. And if this wild hope is true, it's very plausible that the simplest examples of this might have additional nice properties, like integrability. Now, many of us have had discussions with lunchtime discussions with and other discussions with colleagues, where we're reminded over and over again that this theory that we're dealing with is integrable, so all this stuff is going on because it's integrable. That may be, but it doesn't feel like it to me. It doesn't feel like it to me because the style of the progress that's being made is not take the symmetries and impose them and determine the answer. It's completely the opposite. In fact, the symmetries, at least in the amplitude, perturbative amplitude story so far, have not helped to determine the amplitudes at all. We solve, and then we notice that the answer has this infinite dimensional symmetry. Okay? Now, I think the fact that it hasn't been useful to us at weak coupling so far is a clue that we're still missing something, because this is a spectacular thing and we need to understand it. But it just does not have the feeling that, yes, you have this infinite dimensional symmetry, you responsibly apply all these infinitely many generators and you determine the answer. That's certainly not how it's been happening so far. Right. 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 Well, I mean, some things are derived, but anyway, we can talk about it. Oh, I see. Yes. Mm-hmm. It may be. So that's why it says wild hope. But finishing the wild hope is, well, just finishing it, is that the integrability isn't the magic itself. It's a reflection of the magic and a guide to finding it. Well, whatever the reformulation is in any number of dimensions for any field theory. Yeah. It's wild, you know, so I'm allowed to say anything I want. Okay, so. That's true, yeah.
Right, so it might not be every one.
Yeah, sure. There might be some, well, yes. I mean, there. Look, if that's the level of difficulty we have, I'll take it. You know. So really finishing the motivations, Joe had this famous question that that appeared in many of his papers from the early 90s, that the goal of the field was to answer the question, what is string theory? ADS-CFT turned that into the question, what is quantum field theory? Well, many people took the attitude that that's the answer to the question. It's a quantum field theory in the appropriate limits. But you could also take the attitude, and I think it's fruitful, and there's reason to suspect that this is a more correct attitude, that it turns the question into what is quantum field theory? What we thought we understood very well, we may not understand so well. And the fact that there's all this incredible structure in the regime where we thought we understood it for 60 years is an incredibly good hint that there is something going on which we don't understand about it. So, you know, ADS-CFT is this gift from heaven, but after 14 years, we still don't understand where it comes from. We don't know how to prove it. We don't know what makes it tick. We just know that it's true. And if you put a gun to my head 5 years ago, I think to many people's head, and ask them, what's the moral lesson? You would say the moral lesson, the theory is defined, it's the CFT. That's the well-defined thing. And then magically, it's strong coupling, gravity emerges. How? Don't know how. But you know, magical things happen at strong coupling. But now that we're seeing so much structure, even at weak coupling, I think it's plausible that this is more of the picture. That there is a third formulation, T for third, okay? And just like we've seen already in the story for the anomalous dimensions, okay? Even though we don't understand it well enough, we can explain it to me. But there is a third formulation, which happens to match on to perturbative quantum field theory at weak coupling, happens to match to string theory at strong coupling, but it's really something else. And, you know, I would find that a lot more satisfying. Something that always bugged me about this unidirectional arrow is that we made a commitment to the kind of redundancies we are using to describe the physics, right? Oh, gauge redundancies are more fundamental than diff redundancies. That seems a little silly. Okay. It's more likely that there is something which I'm not saying isn't redundant, but will have its own private new kinds of redundancy, perhaps, and which will make it work. And so the path that connects them might not be start from weak coupling and extrapolate, but find this thing and see how to integrate in the appropriate redundancies on the two ends to identify it as a series on both sides. Yes. Well, like I said, I mean, of course that is a very, very important issue. I would say the following. I would say the reason T should exist is because ADS-CFT is true for a gigantic class of theories, not just N equals 4. Some miracle has to happen that turns CFTs into theories of quantum gravity that's very robust, not just at large N, not just for maximal SUSY, okay? Now, it could be that there is a yet second set of miracles completely disconnected from that one that happens in the planar limit, and that even if we fully understand that, that's totally irrelevant to the real set of miracles that happens at subleading order in one. It just sounds very implausible to me. Sounds very implausible. It sounds like we need lots of magic. There's a lot of magic already at infinite n, then even more magic is needed at subleading order in n, not less. But of course, again, we don't know. So this is why this is the motivation and not of the talk. But one thing that we know for sure about T, if it exists, is what I've drawn already, that it connects to all these different parts of physics as well as these incredible new mathematical structures. And in particular, it connects to this branch of mathematics that has been completely parallel to physics so far. Roughly speaking, it's the Grothendieck direction. Okay? The sort of Atiyah direction has made lots of contact with physics. The Grothendieck direction has made no contact with physics for the past 50 years, and it's just stunning to see it sitting at the heart of N equals 4 superangular scattering amplitudes at weak coupling. Okay? All right, so that's really it for the motive. Oh, sorry. the last general comment is a statement about the next frontier. If this, not the scattering amplitude, if this miracle is there, if this happens, if it's really true, it's there for any theory. Sorry, if it's there even for n equals 4 in the planar limit, it should also be true for correlation functions. Okay, and I mention this because correlation functions are actually another hint that we're missing something in the way we think about ADS-CFT. After all, we can say you take the basic sort of holographic lesson that the observables in ADS are the boundary correlation functions. Beautiful. So those are the only observables. Incredible that there's this dual theory that computes them that only lives on the boundaries. Fantastic. That's amazing insight. Now let's say you actually want the damn correlation functions. You actually want to compute them. Okay, great. How do you do it? You say, all right, well, let me start doing it by just computing it in the bulk. Really hard calculation. Okay? No one has done it for 5 points. You do it for 4 points, you bust your ass. It's an incredibly hard, complicated calculation that's strewn over 4 papers by Friedman and friends. It's recombined, and it, when properly recombined and repackaged together, these 4 papers fit on a line. Okay? Where have we heard this before? I would say this correlation function business is in the pre-Park-Taylor phase compared to scattering amplitudes. Okay? There is incredibly little data. It's almost completely virgin territory, as far as I can tell. But there is some structure there. So you start computing correlation function of the weakly couple, then you say, oh, damn, it's really complicated. Then you say, oh, great, but I have this fantastic duality. I'll use the duality. Oh, no, that's also strongly coupled. They can't do it there either. So is that it? Are we, you know, we have this duality. It tells us the observable. It tells us how to relate them. But it's of no help in actually computing it? That sounds ridiculous. Okay? Why is it strongly coupled from the bulk side? For all the same reasons scattering it was complicated. For all the same reasons scattering amplitudes in flat space are. Gauge redundancies, well, diffs in the bulk, and so on. Okay? So there must be some formulation that lets you compute the correlation functions, not just say that they're there and that you could compute them by putting it on some imaginary computer. Okay? So anyway, so I think this is an amazing subject. There's some very interesting recent ideas about it. Well, many people here know more about it than I do, but it's something which is certainly the next frontier after this. Okay? Yes. Yes. Right, right. You know, can I say something? I mean, this is not it's not really germane, but I want to make the comment anyway, which is that one of the things that I like about this business is how anti-Wilsonian it is. You know, after Wilson, you sort of thought, well, all quantum field theories are basically the same. You know, you just look at whether operators are marginal or relevant or irrelevant. Doesn't matter if it's scalars or gravity or Yang-Mills. Doesn't matter if it's relativistic or not. You know, there's just some additional dipsy doodles. This structure is crucially tied into relativity. I mean, it's absolutely critically tied into relativity. None of this beauty happens for phi to the 4 theory in any obvious way. Okay. And so I bring it up just because it may be that it's really different than these lower dimensional systems. It may be there's something that starts happening in spacetimes that are big enough to have gravity, to have all these issues I guess this is just a long way of saying it might just be different. Might be the same, but it might just be essentially different. And it certainly is wonderful to have some high energy theory triumphalism, you know, that this is, none of this stuff happens in some crappy metal, okay? This is, So now let's get down to business. So I saw a little bit of Mark's talk here. So this part of the, so there was a section here on the planar integrand, and I will just say that it exists. Okay, so this is maybe the most important zeroth order, extremely simple but very important point, that while in a general theory there is no such thing as the integrand, in planar theories the integrand is a well-defined rational function of the external momenta and the loop momenta. Okay, and planarity plays a critical role in this. So that means that so it's not the amplitude itself. It's in fact something that has more information than the amplitude. Okay? But it's a nice rational function, and we use momentum twister variables, so it's a nice rational function of the points in momentum twister space, and the loop integration points, which are just points in the dual space that we integrate over, we represent as lines in momentum twister space. So that's what we're after. Okay? Some rational functions as a function of the number of n, k, and l. Okay? All right. Now, if you wanted to do integrals, the simplest integrals that you could do with quotation marks, if you're a physicist, you'd take this thing and you integrate it over for real momenta from minus infinity to infinity. But if you handed this to a mathematician, the first integrals they would do would be on little circles to compute residues. Okay? So, I mean order by order. Yes, I mean order by order. Order by order, I'll just come to this in just a microsecond. But I mean order by order in perturbation theory, there is a well-defined gauge invariant thing associated with the amplitudes, which has more information in it than the amplitudes, and then we do something to it to get the amplitudes, okay? Yeah. Yes. No, in fact, I would rather turn it around and ask. Ignore the polemics either way. This object exists. There are some order by order, but these order by order objects exist. There are data associated with the theory. What could it mean? It's strong coupling. I want to turn, I think it's actually interesting to turn the question around. Is there any candidate for something that's like this? Not the amplitude itself, but something that you integrate to get the amplitude. What could it be at strong coupling? It has to be something special. It should only also exist in the planar limit at strong coupling. But what might it be? I don't know what it is. I mean, a very naive guess is it's some proxy for the world sheet. At least the world sheet effective action is also something that is not the amplitude that you integrate to get the amplitude. I don't know. I do know that there is this. I think that's way too naive. But certainly we can take this object, make a big generating function out of it, call the coefficients g if we want, and then we can ask, what could it mean? It's data associated with the theory. It should mean something. I don't know what it means at strong coupling, but it's a really good question. It's a function. Yeah, it's a function of many momenta, yeah, right, depending on the order. But remember, it's in the planar limit, so this perturbation expansion is convergent. So it does something. I mean, I can take it, I can resum it, it's some function. What does it mean? What is its meaning at strong coupling? I mean, I just mean the perturbation theory is the finite radius of convergence, right? So this thing means something. I can compute a weak coupling, I can extrapolate it, it means something. No, I weight them with the gauge coupling. Okay, I weight with the gauge coupling. I make a right. But I mean, we're used to that in quantum field theory, right? You know, we make a big generating function with some So we do the same thing here. So we multiply and integrate against test functions. So you know, so and really the way of saying it is that and in fact, by the way, something like this. Well, let me not go on that tangent. Building generating functions, so instead of talking about fixed numbers of particles, you really do the analog of what we do in ADS, which is to talk about the effective action as a function of what the classical solutions look like at infinity, would be a really good idea in this business. And it has not been done yet. It has been done in the twister space version of BCFW. This is something that we did a couple of years ago. And it leads to something extremely pretty. I mean, the sort of this recursive structure is much, much nicer on the generating function than it is on the individual objects. So that much, the external particles you can easily take care of, and the loop momentum you do take care of in the analogous way. I mean, this is just a small technicality. I'm talking about a generating one, taking all this data and like a baby, dressing it with the appropriate things, coupling constants and other continuous variables, doing a discrete Fourier transform. So I make a generating function. So it's a function of some continuous variables, and it has, I can extrapolate it to strong coupling because the perturbation theory has a finite radius of convergence. So what does it mean if it's Does it mean anything? Maybe it doesn't mean anything, but I think it's an interesting question. So the simplest integrals that we can do here, then compute residues, and the residues are the famous leading singularities of scattering amplitude. I think Mark reviewed that, but just to okay. So much for the integrand. Now, there's been lots of progress on a number of different fronts. There's been especially exciting progress on the supersymmetric Wilson loop formulation for the scattering amplitudes, and I trust that there will be lots of discussions in this workshop about that. So in this talk, I won't focus so much on that line of investigation. And part of the reason also that I don't want to do that is because for the polemic reasons that I started with. I don't want to trade one space-time description for another space-time description. Okay, I want a non-space-time description of what's going on from the get-go. All right, and many indications so far is that picture is intimately associated with Grassmannians. So let me give a quick review of the story that links scattering amplitudes with the Grassmannian. And I think, again, if you come back after tea, we're starting to see a whole second part of this story, which relates with the Grassmannians in a completely different way. Well, probably not a completely different way, probably in a simply related way. Actually, not a completely different way, but in a different sounding way. Okay, so just a gentle and simple introduction, which at least starts making you see why Grassmannians are going to show up, is to imagine what the geometry of momentum conservation looks like. So imagine, in fact, even before the geometry of momentum conservation, let's just think about the external data, the lambdas and the lambda tildes. Let's just think about them in a slightly different way than we're used to. So each one of these is a two-dimensional vector. A is a Lorentz index that runs from 1 to 2, so is A dot. So any one of these is some vector in an n-dimensional space, where n is a number of particles. So there's some n-dimensional space. I should put a little n there. Okay. So there's a vector here, and there's some other vector for the other component. Similarly for the lambda tildes. Now, that's not a very Lorentz invariant way of talking about it, because the Lorentz group is SL2 cross SL2. So a more Lorentz invariant characterization is in terms of the two-plane, which is spanned by these two lambdas. That's not affected by the Lorentz transformations. So the data, Lorentz invariant, is actually a two-plane lambda and another two-plane lambda tilde that lives in this n-dimensional space. Already before talking about anything else, the external data is associated with two points in the Grassmannian, G2, n, the space of two planes in n dimensions, just the external data. Momentum conservation is the simple statement that these two planes are orthogonal to each other. Okay. Actually, there's no metric here. When I say orthogonal, I really mean that lambda tilde is in the complement of lambda. They're orthogonal. There's no Euclidean metric or anything. But the lambda tilde plane is in the complement of the lambda plane. OK, now, so just to motivate the formula, what we want to do is interpret. So this is a, there's a kind of something as trivial as momentum conservation has a funky nonlinear quadratic form associated with it. Okay, there's this quadric associated with these two points. So momentum conservation is exciting from an on-shell point of view. And that shouldn't surprise you, because momentum conservation is the one thing which is made trivial by the existence of the inside of the spacetime. Okay. And if we're not going to have the inside of the spacetime, then momentum conservation is going to look a little bit exciting. And it does look a little exciting. It's a quadric constraint. Now, all we're going to do is interpret that quadratic constraint as a pair of linear constraints by introducing an auxiliary third object into the story. A k-plane in n dimensions. So imagine you have a k-plane C in n dimensions, and you force the constraints that this plane contains lambda, and it's orthogonal, or in the complement of, lambda tilde. Okay? Clearly, that imposes the constraint that the planes are orthogonal to each other. Now, you might think that this breaks parity, because it treats lambda and lambda tilde differently, but it doesn't, because this is exactly the same statement if I invert the k-plane with its naturally paired n minus k complement plane. Okay? So parity is the natural interchange between k and n minus k. So it's a nice parity invariant statement. Note also that it's impossible if k equals 0 or 1 or n minus 1 or n. And that's good, because those amplitudes vanish. And this is a simple geometric reason for it. Now, how do we say this in equations? I just want to say that picture in equations. So first, let's talk about how do I represent the k-plane in n dimensions? Well, I just give you k vectors, k n-dimensional vectors whose span gives me that space. Let me assemble those k n-dimensional vectors into a k by n matrix. Now, if this is indeed going to represent the point, if this is going to represent the plane, anything I do with this matrix, it better be invariant under GLK transformations that just change the basis without changing what the k-plane is. So there is a new redundancy here. We have to have GLK. Okay? We don't have gauge redundancy, but we have GLK. Anything we do with C has to be GLK invariant. And so what we're talking about is the Grassmannian GKN. And from this argument, you see that its dimensionality is K times N minus K squared, which is K times N minus K, which is nicely symmetrical under flipping K and N minus K. All right, so now we know how to talk about a K-plane in N dimensions. Let's write down an equation that enforces that picture for momentum conservation. So here it is. I write down a delta function that says that the k-plane is orthogonal to lambda tilde. Then I have to write something that says that the k-plane contains lambda. So to say that it contains lambda, you integrate over all possible linear combinations of the vectors in C that you can. And C, is there one such linear combination that's equal to the lambdas? Okay, so that's what this little integral is doing. Okay, it's searching for a linear combination that makes the linear combination of these vectors equal to lambda. That's it. So these equations enforce that picture. However, you can see that you're not quite done, because this is not GLK invariant. It's SLK invariant, but it's not GLK invariant, because if you just rescale the C's by an overall constant, those delta functions have Jacobians. So for this reason, and this reason alone, from this point of view, the simplest thing you can do, not the unique thing you can do, but the absolute simplest thing you can do, is to just add four fermionic variables. Add four fermionic variables, you enforce this delta function. Now the Jacobian of the fermions cancels the Jacobian of the bosons, and now you are making a statement about K-planes. So supersymmetry here is very closely tied up with the Grassmannian. It's very closely tied up with making a legal statement about K-planes in n dimensions. So now we're talking about n equals 4 super Yang nulls.
Okay.
This is linearizing momentum conservation, right? Yeah, that's right. We'll come to that. We'll come to that in just yes, they're the same. Yes. Well, you'll see how they're the same. All right. Now that object looks a little bit funny, but if you Fourier transform the Twister space, it's just this incredibly simple, beautiful thing. It just says that this K-plane is orthogonal to the four-plane of Twister variables, W. So that whole kaboodle, I mean, I didn't have to give you any of that argument. I could have just said this is a nice object, but I just wanted you to see what a simple idea it is. Okay, and this makes it completely clear anything we do with this is superconformal invariant. Okay? By going to Twister space, it makes it obviously superconformal invariant. All right, for k equals 0, 1, n minus 1, or n, there are no k-planes that satisfy these constraints. If k equals 2 or n minus 2, there's a unique plane that satisfies these constraints. But for general k and n, there's many planes, and we need to integrate over them. Okay. And so we have to integrate over the Grassmannian with some measure. Now, this is where all of the magic happens. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's not, I mean, which plane should I use? I'm enforcing momentum conservation. If there isn't a unique plane, I should integrate over them. Okay. I mean, that's I think, reasonable. Huh? Well, I mean, okay. I'm integrating over them, okay? Now, so this is really where all the magic happens, because in order to have a measure, which is GLK invariant, if I just write it so I can divide out by the volume of GLK, so there's K times N C's up here. But again, this isn't a GLK invariant. It's SLK, but not GLK invariant. The only way I can make it invariant into the G, I have to have some C's downstairs. Well, it minimally should be SLK invariant, so anything I do should be made out of the minors of this K by N matrix. I take K of the columns of this K by N matrix, and I take its determinant. That's SLK invariant. And then you have to have N minors downstairs in total for the whole measure to be GLK invariant, for the constant multiplicative multiplication by C to cancel. Okay? Now, you could put any sequence of minors downstairs that you like. Now we have some extra things from physics. We know that we want the answer to have a nice cyclic symmetry, okay? Because we're talking about gluons, and we're talking about the color-ordered thing. So it's natural to have a cyclic structure. Even saying there's a cyclic structure doesn't uniquely fix it. I can take any minor I want and multiply by all of its cyclic friends. But this is somehow the simplest thing that you could write down. Just the first k consecutive guys, the next k consecutive guys, the next k consecutive guys, multiplying them all the way around. In a second, we'll give the non-aesthetic argument for it. But this is certainly also aesthetically true. Okay. Okay. So that's it. That makes the object. So we have this thing, which is just coming from that picture about momentum conservation, or it's alternately just the sort of simplest dependence on kinematics you can have in Twister space, the sort of simplest cyclic measure that you can have in the Grassmannian. So we're motivated to write down this object. And the remarkable fact is that this object seems to know about and generates, in a specific sense, all loop scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 degree mil. Yeah? No. You will not. So this is the entire magic in this business. And the reason why it's not in all the math books, in all the algebraic geometry books, okay? This cyclic structure on Grassmannians is not natural to the mathematicians. So, I mean, they've been playing with the Grassmannian for 150 years, but they had no reason to put cyclic structures on it. A few people very recently have been, independently, but very recently, like a couple of years ago. And I can tell you from the discussion with some of my friends at the Institute that there's some excitement they're seeing for their private reasons why the cyclic structure is something very, very nice. But that's really the reason why, well, when we first ran into this, I was sure we'd open up Griffiths and Harris and we'd be done, you know, that in the back of the book somewhere. But it's not, and it's really this thing. It's the cyclic structure has not been intensively explored. That's where all of the magic is. Yeah. Right. That was kind of automatic. That was automatic. Yeah. That was just automatic. Like I said, this whole picture is just fun and games. I mean, I could have just immediately written this thing down and saved, geez, quite a lot of time. But it's useful for something else. Okay. So in particular, the first thing that we observed about it, before getting to the all loop integrand, the first thing that we observed, because this thing is not a function of loop momentum variables, right? This thing is only a function of the external data. It doesn't depend on loop integration variables at all. So in what sense could it be related to the all loop integrand? Well, there is a piece of data associated with the all loop integrand which doesn't depend on the external data. It doesn't depend on the loop momentum. Do the integrals. But do the integrals on the little contours. So the residues of the loop integrand, the leading singularities. So we have two integrands in the world. There's the Feynman loop integrand. That's one integrand. There's this Grassmannian integral. That's another thing. Okay? On both of these objects, we interpret them as contour integrals, and we compute residues. So we get a list of objects. From quantum field theory, that list of objects had a name called leading singularities. On this side, they're just Grassmannian residues. Okay? And the claim is that these two lists are identical. For all k and n, for any k and any n, yeah. For example, for any, and k is the number of negative helicity particles. It's the overall R charge of the component in the superamplitude. Now, I could spend a long time just talking about this part of the story, which I don't want to do, but I should say that just in the list of leading singularities in field theory, there's lots of mysterious structures in those objects. For example. Here's an extremely basic thing. It's completely clear may not be totally clear yet. Let me not say it. But I will say this: what is known is that these guys have to satisfy many, many relations that follow from locality and unitarity. Okay, leading singularities satisfy many, many relations that follow. Rather explicitly from locality and unitarity. Now you can ask, since these objects are being generated by a totally different beast, yeah. Yes. The loop, yes. That's right. Yes, right. Exactly. So good. Yes. Which doesn't, it doesn't have L. It doesn't have a loop order in it. This is one of many things that are made that this correspondence illuminates. Because what happens, you would think, just like what you said, you would think there's more and more and more and more and more objects as you go to higher and higher loops. But people discovered experimentally that they stopped. So you're doing like, no one did a 100-loop thing, but you're doing a 3-loop calculation, there are no new leading singularities. They're the same ones as you encountered at lower loops. Completely unobvious. It's totally unobvious just screwing around with the diagrams, okay? Yeah. Let's say you do a 100-loop MHV calculation. Yeah. Bazillions. Yes, bazillions. Yes, it's a function of 100 variables, and you would expect zillions of different leading singularities. Okay. Oh, I mean, you expect way, way more. But anyway. But yes, indeed. I mean, it grows much more rapidly. But yes, indeed, you would expect something like that. Yeah. And it's a very incredibly non-trivial fact that they run out. That even though there are many different residues that you can compute, the rational function that you get is the same, over and over and over again. Past a certain loop order, you just run out of new objects. You just keep getting the same things over and over again. So if you have a function of n complex variables, to compute a residue, you find you have to find single, yeah. Yeah. Right. Yes. 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 I'm saying that in principle, ahead of time, you might have expected an infinite number of objects. And it's a remarkable fact about the Exactly. Of course, the function is a function of an arbitrary large number of variables. Then you could ask for residues for 100 loops or 1,000 loops or 10,000 loops. Right. Right. Absolutely. Right. Yeah. That's the point. Indeed, it doesn't. Indeed, it doesn't. No, you just don't get anything new again. Yeah. Yeah. So. No. Yeah. Sorry. No. So. Perhaps the issue was that. Was indeed defining what we mean by the residue, okay? If you have n complex variables, you have to find a place where locally it looks like one of z1 up to zn, okay? Yeah. Yes. Yep. Yep. And what I'm saying is that, yeah. Doesn't know about that. Yes, absolutely. Right. So it makes an immediate prediction. It was incredibly falsifiable. It makes an immediate prediction that the total number of different rational functions that you get is bounded. The total number of different, they're not rational, the total number of different algebraic functions that you get out of this procedure of computed residues is bounded. For example, stunningly for MHV, it's always the MHV tree amplitude, nothing else. You never get any other rational function. Okay? That's incredibly unobvious fact, just drawing these pictures of gluing things together, you know. It's all perturbation theory, it's weakly coupled, it's boring as hell, but there is a stunning fact that you do this 100 loop calculation and you just get the tree amplitude over and over again. Totally non-obvious, built in into this statement. Right. The 100 loop integrand, and then you compute its residues. You compute its residues. No, of course not. No, the 100 loop integrand is a complicated function of 100 variables. But its residues are equal to the MHV tree amplitude. You see, when you take the residue, you lose information about the integration variables, right? It's just a function of the external data. Okay? And what you get out of it is there are algebraic functions of the external data. It's algebraic because you're solving a ton of polynomial equations to put all those intermediate propagators on shell. So that's what I'm saying. There's two collections of algebraic functions. One, the collection that you get from leading singularities of field theory. It's not even obvious from this definition that it's bounded, right? There are many other unobvious things. They satisfy all these relations, all these linear relations, which are a consequence of locality and unitarity. They're incredibly non-trivial identities between these algebraic functions, okay? So both the fact that there's a finite number of them and the non-trivial relations, none of those things are at all obvious from standard perturbation theory. The claim is that both of those things are made obvious by this other formula. This other formula tells you that there's a one-to-one correspondence. Now, by now, this is a proven statement. We know exactly how to identify which residue on this side, which a given leading singularity, which residue does it look like on that side. I mean, the map is understood perfectly now. But I wanted to move on to talk about the integrand. But I did want to just But this is the first thing that. That it does. Now, we understand much better now, though, what the sort of point of this, why this object exists. Okay? Because what it really does is make dual superconformal invariants manifest, or at least as manifest as possible that we've seen right now. Maybe there's an even better way of making it manifest, but this is really extremely, this is pretty simple enough. So if we go back to this picture of this momentum conservation picture, you see, it's asking you to do something naturally, geometrically. No, it's true for each residue individually. Yeah, each residue individually in the loop integrand is some particular residue of the Grassmannian. And we know the map exactly now. We know how to go from one, we know how to tell you exactly which residue it is. After the break, I'll have a lot more to say about this sort of internal structure inside the Grassmannian, which we understand much, much better now. But let me just keep going for a bit now. But this geometric picture asks you to do something. It says, look, it's really dumb to integrate over k-planes that contain this two-plane. Why are you integrating over all of them? Just integrate over the k-2 planes that are transverse to both. Right? That's a very natural thing to want to do geometrically. But there's a catch, because if you want it to be an integral over k-2 planes in n dimensions, the measure that you need should be made out of k-2 by k-2 minors, not k by k minors. And the measure that we have is made out of k by k minors. Now, there's an old trick that people in the pre-Mathematica days were taught in high school for how to compute determinants of matrices. And you can use that trick. Okay? And you find that you can map k by k to k minus 2 by k minus 2, but only one minor at a time. That's where the magic of the cyclic structure, one of the first places it comes in. Because with that cyclic structure, you can actually do it for all of them. Okay? Only with the cyclic structure. But with the cyclic structure, you can do it for all of them. And in fact, you do it by doing, this trick is just doing a little linear transformation. And you find very quickly that you get a formula that pulls out in front delta functions for momentum conservation, super momentum conservation, in fact, the whole MHV super tree super amplitude on the left. And what it multiplies is something that remarkably has exactly the same structure, except now it's k minus 2, p is k minus 2. Okay? What I had before, what I called C before, I called D. And the linear transformation that I had, you see, in momentum space, I had lambdas and lambda tildes here. That little linear transformation is now linear transformed version of those lambdas and lambda tildes. Okay? What you find, remarkably, you regroup back up into a new delta 4/4. So you've discovered, out of nowhere, a new superconformal invariance that acts on these variables capital Z. And then if you look inside and you look at what that linear transformation is, it's exactly Andrew's linear transformation to go from momentum variables to momentum twister variables. Okay? So this is how the Grassmannian invents momentum twister space for you. Okay? So your desire to follow the geometry, and because of the magic of those cyclic minors, you see that you get exactly the same structure now in momentum twister space. So this makes dual superconformal symmetry manifest. And P is K minus 2. Okay? Now, one more thing here is that so let me just say a few small formal comments. So all these pictures of momentum conservation, it's all fun and games, but the non-trivial statement is the following: Why do the Grassmannian make an appearance? You can show, and it was shown in a number of nice papers around 8 months ago by Drummond and Farrow and by Kochamsky and Sokachev, that if your goal in life is to write down superconformal invariants, period. That any superconformal invariant is an integral over a Grassmannian delta 4/4 c dot w. Okay, so here we sort of ran into it. We just ran into it from our picture, and anyway. But this guy, that thing is obviously superconformal invariant. But the claim is that any superconformal invariant is an integral over a Grassmannian of delta 4/4 c dot w with some measure. That's claim one. So that's, in a sense, what explains, if you like, here I presented from a more Grassmannian-centered point of view. Supersymmetry is natural for the Grassmannian, right? Because we needed to talk about k-planes and so on. You can reverse it and say, if you're just writing down superconformal invariants, all superconformal invariants are integrals over the Grassmannian. But if you want it to also be dual superconformal invariant, the unique object which is dual superconformal invariant is this thing with the cyclic minors. So that proves that this Grassmannian integral is the generating function of all Yangian invariants. So it's the answer to that mathematical physics problem. Also, because it's a contour integral, there are residue theorems that give you zillions of relationships between all these things, which have physical importance. And again, I'll talk a lot more about this after the break. Okay. So that's really the point. That's really the point of these guys. They're making the whole Yangian invariant, And they can do it because they don't care at all about space-time. Okay? It's not making any commitment to one space-time, the dual space-time. The entire external world is just buried in the stupid delta function here. Okay? All the action is happening inside the Grassmannian. And depending on what you attach to it, you get the answers to a question in one space-time or the dual space-time. Okay. All right, now let's move on to talk about the full loop integrand. And now, I could at this point just tell you about how BCFW recursion works at loop level. And really, once you know that there is such a thing as the loop integrand, we know about its singularities, just like we know at tree level. And very crucially, we know that the single cuts of these amplitudes are well defined in supersymmetric theories, and certainly in n equals 4 super Yang nulls. I could just give you the BCFW recursion relation without ever saying the word Yangian, even dual conformal symmetry, nothing. I could say it in momentum space, just like it was originally done by BC and F, okay, without knowing any of these things. And that's actually perhaps quite powerful. It's something that more should be done with, because we know we can get going with this kind of recursive structure, at least in n equals 1 theory, certainly to one loop, probably to higher loops. And Simone understands more about how this single cut structure than I do. People here should feel free to talk to them if they're interested. But that's really something that should be, I think, explored a lot more. But I want to emphasize that we could talk about this all-loop recursion without all this machinery, just like BCNF did BCFW, BCFW did BCFW without knowing all of that. But of course, what I'm trying to do here is tell you how it fits and show you that all the objects have incredibly natural Grassmannian interpretations, and why you would think of them from that point of view. So a path towards understanding at least the things that occur in the all-loop recursion are to just first play with the residues that we get from the Grassmannian integral, play with these basic Yangian invariants, and find the sort of simple operations that you can, simple tinker toy operations that you can do that makes new ones from old ones. Okay, so. And this is really all of them. This is so you can take two of them together. If they don't share any labels, you can just flat out multiply them, and you get a new invariant. Okay? You can remove a particle. Okay? So if this is a Yangian invariant, that's a Yangian invariant. That's a residue. That's a residue. The product of it is a residue in the appropriate higher dimensional object. Okay? You can take an existing invariant and remove a particle simply by integrating over it. You can remove it in another way. You can remove it by merging it with one of its neighbors. Okay. You can also add a particle where you didn't have one before. Okay. And those are the basic operations. If you take the invariants and put them together in this way, and every natural way of putting them together has a physics name. Okay. Right. So I'm telling you, if someone hands you a residue in a lower point Grassmannian, how to build one that's guaranteed to be a residue of the higher point Grassmannian. There's just an operation for adding a particle. Okay? And you can prove all of these things trivially from the structure of that from that integral. Again, the cyclic minors are crucial to the whole story. Really, the way the cyclicity comes up is every time you need some little tiny miraculous identity about determinants, and every time it's true. Okay? So there's a lot of little determinant identities that they're not miraculous, but the cyclic structure is crucial in many, many places. So for example, in usual BCFW recursion, you take two objects together and you jam them together to make a third object. That's a simple combination of these basic tinker toy operations. I haven't shown you explicitly what it is, but I'll just call it. It's true not just for tree ampli, it's just a general thing you can do on any two residues. Okay, so I'll call that piece star BCFW. But now we've got to talk about where loops come from. Okay? So, I mean, even without thinking about it very much, it's obvious that if there's some recursive structure at loop level, it'll have a piece that looks just like BCFW, where you have, you know, L1 loops on this side, L2 loops on this side, they're jammed together, where L1 plus L2 is equal to the total number of loops. Okay? But if you just had that, you would never have non-trivial loop amplitudes, because you could reduce everything down to the three-point loop amplitude, which vanishes. So you need a source that tells you that loop amplitudes are non-zero. You need a quantum source. Okay? And this is the origin of loops. This is where loop integrals come from in this picture. So to motivate it, imagine that somehow you thought the fundamental object. This is, I think, an interesting general qualitative insight that we've seen over and over in this story, that you're used to thinking about amplitudes for a few number of particles because it looks simpler. But it looks like the basic fundamental object wants to have an infinite number of particles. Okay? And really, a lot of the true simplicity really manifests out at an infinite number of particles and is sort of accidentally hidden at a small number of particles. Okay? But so imagine you have an infinite number of particles, but you don't want to talk about an infinite number of particles. You want to talk about a finite number of particles. So you should somehow hide infinity minus n of them and just examine n of them, right? Since we have these simple operations for removing particles, there's a very simple way of doing that. Just start with infinity and just remove infinity minus n of them until you get down to the one that you want. Now, if you do that one particle at a time, remember, removing involved integrating over these particles. So when I say do it one particle at a time, I mean all these integrals are contour integrals. All of them are contour integrals. So I mean choose the contour for this particle. Just choose it, totally independent of the contour for the next one. So choose this one first, then choose the next one, then choose the next one until you go down. If you do that, you find you don't get any interesting new objects. If you start from tree amplitudes, you get the tree amplitudes. Nothing interesting happens. But there's an essentially unique second thing that you can do. It is unique. It's not essentially unique. It's a unique second thing that you can do, which is when you remove this particle, you can remove the one next to it, but you're not going to remove them independently. You're going to remove them on an entangled contour. Okay. What do I mean by entangled? I mean literally that I'm integrating over A, remember, and integrating over B, but I don't want to integrate over them independently. So what's the only relationship they can have possibly with each other? There are two points in projective space, so they define a line. So the only possible way I can entangle them is to, I don't want to treat A and B asymmetrically. So what I can do is first integrate over the positions of A and B along the line. So I do that as a little contour integral. Okay. Now, what I'm left with is a new function that doesn't depend on A and B separately, but only depends on the line AB. Okay? That's my loop integrand. Because remember, the loop integration variables are lines in momentum twister space. Okay. So the reason these loop variables exist, they're really, really in the underlying picture, we're just removing particles. But this entangled contour takes you from a pair of particles to losing the memory of everything but the line that they form, which is the loop integration variable. Then you have to integrate to get the full amplitude, you integrate over all the lines. But if you want to stop at the level of the integrand, you just do that. Okay? So in a really specific sense, the quantum effects come from entangled removal of a pair of particles. Really, if you did it on a different contour, you just get the tree amplitude. Nothing new. Okay? It's a literal choice of contour. Entangle them, don't entangle them, boring. Entangle them, it's loops.
So why do you prep
the infinite
number of particles?
No, right. So you would, and we had an infinite number of loop orders. So that picture was sort of Yeah, I'm just telling you, this is where loop integrals come from in our story, okay? They come. Now, if you run through the argument for BCFW recursion, so again, once you know the integrand exists, there's, once again, you take two particles, you deform them, you look for the singularities. There's two kinds of singularity. There's the singularities involving the factorization channels of external particles, and there's singularities where a single loop momentum, between the two adjacent particles goes on shell. So that's a single cut. And we just need to know the residues at both of them. Okay? And as I mentioned already, we could in principle do this all without ever saying any of this stuff. Although actually, in practice, computing these single cut terms is a lot more effective, at least easy, with this machinery. But in any case, this is the answer. Okay? So that's the formula for the all-loop recursion relation. Okay? And each one of these is a very concrete, simple formula. So that's the BCFW jamming of the two lower point guys together. And the quantum seed is the entangled removal of this pair of particles. Now, This equation, of course, reminds you. So that's it. That's the integrand for n equals 4 super Young Mills. You can put it in Mathematica. You can press Shift Enter. You wait a little while, and you have the 27 particle two loop amplitude on your desktop. Okay. So actually, this is something not me, but perhaps Jake Bergeli, who's already made the tree BCFW package available, so it can be on your Mathematica, on your laptop. If you want, the plan is that sometime this summer, if we find the time, or he finds the time, we'll make this publicly available. So anyone can have any loop order or super Young Mills on their laptops. It's a short Mathematica code. The integrand, yes, of course. Of course, by the way, this equation is very familiar to, we've seen equations like this all over the place. So, you know, this looks a lot like the Joe's exact Wilson renormalization group equation, for example, right? Precisely the same thing. There's the classical piece from the, and there's the quantum piece. This sort of structure is ubiquitous all over the place, but it's, now, this way of presenting it, the point of presenting it this way is two. A, it makes it completely clear this object is Yang invariant, because I'm just building it out of the, using the canonical operations that we talked about. B, it's extremely simple. It's computationally effective. And I forget what C was. Okay. So it's a complete definition of the theory to all orders of perturbation theory. And I remind you, it's a finite radius of convergence, so that's more than in QCD. So with the Yang symmetry completely manifest, and where, again, at least as promised from the polemics, the words space-time, Lagrangian, path integral, gate symmetry, etc., did not make a single appearance. Okay. As I mentioned, and as many of you know, and there will be lots of discussion about it, in the dual space-time, so there is something which is manifestly Yang invariant. Its name in space-time is a scattering amplitude. It must have a name in the dual space-time because it's Yang invariant. We've known that the name has something to do with Wilson loops for a long time, and due to this beautiful work that happened last fall, we know precisely which supersymmetric Wilson loop it corresponds to. Okay? So there's now perfect symmetry established between the two space-time word descriptions of what this object is. Okay? And there's lots of beautiful things to do, but again, there will be discussions of that here. Now, so it's helpful to have the integrand sitting on your laptop because you can stare at it, you have the answers. So I guess this is one of the messages. There is no data bottleneck anymore for the integrand for planar n equals 4 super Young Mills. In the sense that if you want it, if you have some guess, if you have some question about it, you want to check something, it's available. Okay. Well, it'll be publicly available, but if you have a burning question, you could send it to us, and we'll answer it. Okay. But looking at it has shown some amazing simplicity in the structure of the integrand, even beyond what seems to be there just from the structure of the recursion. This, I must say, to me was a very big surprise because I had never seen anything simpler than BCFW for amplitudes. But there seems to be an even simpler structure than that, which we have some understanding of, but no derivation of. But that's, again, part of the discussion for after tea. So in the spirit of incredible calculations of a year and a half ago, which are already incredible then, getting even more simplified now, this is a picture of a Christian's calculation for the MHV two-loop amplitudes from, I guess, August this year, about a year and a half ago, right? So this is already just a stupendous result. Okay, this is all MHV two-loop amplitudes. Had you asked me 5 years ago, would anyone know all MHV two-loop amplitudes? See, completely ridiculous, you know. But Christian did it. Okay, so it's this. There's maybe five more pages that look like that, but it's there. The answer is there. So these brackets are some rational functions. These are different integral topologies, and so on. Okay. Actually, in a specific sense, it's half the answer. It's the so-called parity-even part of the answer. But anyway. So now, this is the status as of December. So at the level of the integrand, all two-loop MHV amplitudes are the top line. Now I have to tell you what those wiggly lines mean. Okay, and this is part of the important point, is that these integrals are not naturally represented as standard loop integrals in. They're naturally written as integrals over lines in momentum twister space. Okay, the momentum twistorial structure is crucial for seeing the simplicity. It's not like you've got to do any funny Fourier transform or anything. You can trivially read off the standard loop integral from this. But the standard loop integral would look complicated. It would have numerator factors. It's not the sort of thing that you would try to do. In fact, the sort of thing you'd try to do is try to make it look as naively simple as possible. But that action of making it naively as simple as possible is actually making it a lot more complicated. And furthermore, the idea of splitting into pieces that are even and odd is making it more complicated. It doesn't want to be split like that. The amplitude is chiral, naturally, after all. Okay. So these wiggly lines, again, after tea, if anyone's interested, or you could talk to the people who are here, they could explain what these pictures mean. But it's just a way of representing a particular integral over lines in momentum twister space. Okay. Next, MHV amplitudes. None were known till the summer in any theory at two loops. Then in the summer, our paper and Christian and David Kossauer and friends computed the 6-point. And we were very happy that we could do it, but even then, our answer was way too complicated. Looking at it a little more, this is all of them. Okay, all two-loop NMHB amplitudes. It fits on a line. This is all three-loop MHV amplitudes. The 5-point one was known, I guess, 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. That's all of them. So this stuff works. Okay. Now, this is not the form that the all-loop recursion spits it out in. So what? There's some extra processing here. You stare at it. In fact, this began as a consistency check on the answer. After all, no one has computed these amplitudes before, so why should you believe us? Maybe we screwed up. Maybe it's wrong. Okay. But a very powerful check is that the BCFW recursion guarantees that the cuts work out, but it's a very non-trivial check that the answer is local. Okay, that's the usual tension with BCFW. And so the way we're sure that this formula is right is that you check it for 30 particles. For 30 particles, there's 99,000 terms in the BCFW recursion. They all have to have the correct sign, otherwise these spurious poles don't cancel. They all cancel. The answer is local, and it's that local answer. Okay. So now the BCFW form is also very pretty and very simple. But there's another form out there. There are these local forms out there, which are amazingly simple, and we don't know where they come from right now. Okay? We don't know an algorithm for generating them. So what we've done here is get the answer using BCFW recursion and then pattern recognize. Some of my collaborators have developed a mind meld with n equals 4 superyang melds, so they know what it wants to do, and you know, you just find the pattern, and off they go into the night, and they come back, and they know the answer somehow. It's incredible, but it is pattern recognition. Okay, some of it isn't pattern recognition anymore, So it's useful to have the data. It's useful to have this formulation of the theory. And there's a hint of something we don't understand still. Where do these local forms come from? Okay, so I'm now starting to wrap up. So here's one big zeroth order question. Where do these local forms come from? How do we get them directly? And roughly speaking, what's been going on in this business so far is that we've had a sort of a big asymmetry. We have BCFW forms and other related forms, and these things, part of the reason they could be guessed, they're closely related to unitarity, generalized unitarity, and so on, they're very unitarity related. And the whole point is that they get you things that are not manifestly local, but they're manifestly unitary. Okay? There must be some symmetry. The fact that these local forms exist is telling you there must be some formulation that gives you the local answers directly, but are not manifestly unitary. And by the way, those formulas are not manifestly unitary. They're not term by term. They don't have the correct cut. Okay. So that must exist. Now, a funny thing happened, which has happened to Zvi 100 times, which is that we ran into these funny non-local local objects at two loops, and it was a big surprise. Why are these funny local things there? We've never seen any simple local tree amplitudes even. wait a minute, should there be simple local tree amplitudes? Is that possible? Is there any possible new story for tree amplitudes that hasn't been known? Damn straight there is. There are local forms of tree amplitudes that are incredibly simple, which are not term by term unitary. They don't term by term have the correct cuts, but they're manifestly local. So when before, at least I would say, or the people would say, that the bad thing about what makes Feynman diagrams complicated is that they're manifestly local. BCFW is great because it allows spurious poles. That's what makes the answer simple. It's actually more than that. Feynman diagrams are making both locality and unitarity manifest. And if you give up either one, you can get very, very simple forms. Yes? This is also an important point. The kind of notion of locality here is a very minimal one. It's just that the poles are local poles. So these are rational functions. The only kind of pole they're allowed to have is 1 over x minus y squared in space time. Okay? It's not that it comes from a Lagrangian or anything, but I guess what I really mean is that they're not non-local, or at least they're not obviously non-local. So most forms that we're used to are obviously non-local, term by term, and only the sum, in the sense that they have poles that do not look like 1 over x minus y squared. It's some spinner thing where if you rationalize it, in momentum space, it's like instead of 1 over p squared, which is legal, not even square roots. It's like 1 over p1 squared, p2 squared, minus p3 squared, p4 squared. It's things like that, where those p's are sums of external p's. Okay? So those are totally illegal poles. They don't correspond to any sort of picture of a local process in space-time. And BCFW is riddled with them. Okay? It depends on your attitude, because BCFW is designed to match the cuts. So it matched the cuts correctly, but at the expense of making it not local. These other forms are manifestly true. So really, there's one consistent object, okay? But I'm talking about the sort of attitude of what it's trying to make manifest. It's trying to make unitarity manifest. These other things make locality manifest, but not unitary. If I take the cut of any one of these terms, it's completely wrong. Okay? Of course, the sum is correct, and the sums match. Right. Sure. Now, so this actually very strongly suggests that there's still something about the integrand we need to understand a lot better. Okay? And in a quite specific sense Andrew in his talk talked about this probably in some examples, but it seems very likely, very, very, very generally, that in quite a specific sense, the amplitudes are to be thought of as the volume of something, the volume of some polytope in some abstract space. Okay? After tea, I'll tell you a little bit what I think that space looks like. But the point is that, I mean, let's take this trivial example. Let's say you want the area of that little trapezoid, okay? If you want to actually compute the area, you want to triangulate that trapezoid. So for example, you could triangulate it by having that area minus that area, or that area minus that area, or that area plus that area. There's many different ways of triangulating that object, and it looks like different ways of triangulating make different physical properties manifest. Okay? So one set of triangulations give you BCFW type forms. That makes Yang-Yin invariance manifest. It's very closely related to making unitarity manifest. But there should be other ways of triangulating it that make locality manifest. Okay? And so that's why there's something still dissatisfying about the characterization that we've given of the integrand in terms of this BCFW recursion. It's unsatisfying because, in a sense, we've given a description of the theory that has all the symmetries manifest, but it's presented as a triangulation of something without telling you what you've triangulated. It's like I gave you that little, it's like I gave you a more complicated green region, but I just handed you a bunch of the triangles. I add up the areas of these triangles, and you're done. That's true, you get the right answer. But clearly you learn a lot more if I told you, if you put them together, it makes a trapezoid, okay? So what's good is that we have the answer. There's a beachhead, okay? We have the answer, the data is there, so you can test anything you want on it, and you can think about it. But what's still missing is a picture, right? Now, a beautiful picture exists on both space-times. Again, I emphasize scattering amplitudes, the Wilson loop, These are space-time pictures for what's going on that are beautiful and perfect. They're done. They're complete. They have gauge redundancy. They're local. They have all the, so there's reasons to want this intermediate formalism that doesn't commit to either space-time. Okay? But now, what we're missing for it is something that's an invariant definition of what it is, rather than a recursive definition. This is an even more prosaic way of saying it. When someone hands you a recursion relation, usually that recursion relation is the answer to some problem. Okay? We want to know what the problem is, what the question is that the recursion relation is the answer to. Okay? Because whatever that question is a question formulated in this Grassmannian world, which must be such a natural question that the mathematical structure involved spits out an answer that has locality and unitarity as emergent properties. Okay? Yes. Yes. So the order, the loop order, is not the, it plays, yeah, the coupling constant plays no role in this story at all, okay? Because there's a different integrand at different loop orders, right. However, it's not as stupid as that. I mean, it's because where the natural reason, and can I come back to this issue in just a little bit? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what's the question? Oh, okay. Good. Yeah. So no. First of all, I mean, just, no. So right. But no, I just meant the recursion relation. I just meant the recursive definition, the one I just presented. This formula. This is a beautiful little combinatorial formula. Okay, I didn't emphasize enough. These things are incredibly combinatorial. When you're in this world, everything is completely combinatorial. Okay, all the information about the answer and the continuous things come in at the very end of the and you don't even care about them. Okay, so you're manipulating. Anyway, it's very, very combinatorial. This is an extremely simple combinatorial structure. And it's the answer to some question. I don't know what question it's the answer to. It's not, even though it's in principle, this completely defines the amplitude, okay? The integrand. And in principle, it completely defines the integrand. But it's unsatisfying because the real reason it's unsatisfying is that we derived this from quantum field theory, right? So if we never knew about quantum field theory, you know, these are sort of fairly natural things to do with these things, but why would you do it? Why would you do this and add that and What's the point, right?
So you're probably at this level of locality is not obvious.
No, well, certainly locality is not obvious, okay? Right. Yes. No, of course it's not manifest. No, locality. No, neither locality nor unitarity. None of these things play any role. We just have some k-planes in n dimensions, okay? So, and yet there are these incredibly simple canonical things you can do to them, and you glue them together in this way, and they give you an answer which is local and unitary. Now, how do we know this answer is local and unitary? Secretly, we compute it with quantum field theory, you know? Don't tell anyone. But just like BCFW, derive BCFW from the known singularity structure of Feynman diagrams, the evil F word, right? So similarly here, it's just exactly the update of the strategy, right? But given that the answer is so naturally expressed in terms of these simple operations on this object, that leads you to suspect that it is also the answer to some question naturally framed in this Grassmannian world. And it would be really good to know what that question is. And I will talk about some ideas for what it is. So that's the thing which is unsatisfying. It's unsatisfying to say, oh, this is the whole thing, it's just this recursive thing, and that's it. Ah, by the way, even more sharply, I keep saying it makes all the symmetries manifest, but I'm lying. There's one symmetry that it does not make manifest. It does not make the cyclic symmetry of the answer manifest. Okay? Because when you do BCFW recursion, you always pick two particles. Okay? Yeah. Now, no. It's not a typo. It's the operation where you add particle one to that thing, and then you remove two particles. So I didn't open these things up. I mean. The problem is, when I've given this talk, I mean, it's very important to open this up and talk about what these things are, but just talking about them in any detail takes me an hour. But what it is literally, you take this lower point thing, you add particle one using the rule, You remove these particles in an entangled way, and then you hid the fact that you remove them in an entangled way by merging one with its neighbor.
Okay?
Huh? Oh, it's because this BCFW recursion involved shifting momentum twister n in the direction of n minus 1. So that's where you break the cyclic invariance. So the particle n is special. n is special, you shift n in the direction n minus 1. And so you get a formula that's not obviously cyclically invariant. Okay? Now, of course, the underlying quantum field theory guarantees that the answer is cyclically invariant. But you can again ask, is there some way you can see that directly without ever referring to that? There's a bunch of identities that these objects satisfy that guarantee cyclic invariance. We've seen this sort of thing and understand it incredibly well at tree level. And it persists at loop level. These, even though we understand it much less well, but these identities do not, you don't need to go all the way back to quantum field theory to prove them. The identities are proved within this world all by itself. Okay? Which again suggests that there is some invariant question this is the answer to that makes it obvious. And again, I'll have a lot more to say about that after the break. Yeah, it looks like loop equations, it looks like these, like I said, we've seen these kinds of equations 100 times, okay? But it'd be nice to, as usual, make it a lot sharper. Yeah, sorry, David. Okay. Andrew mentioned in his talk, in some simple cases, this is understood really perfectly well. For NMHV tree amplitudes, there is a picture that for what the amplitudes are, which beautifully connects to the Grassmannian, it's everything you might want. I'll describe it. Andrew described it. I'll use it as a starting off point. I'll review it quickly before generalizing it after the break. But it's literally that there is some beautiful invariantly defined polytope. It lives in CP4. Not CP3, it lives in CP4. And if you triangulate it in one way, it's manifestly built out of BCFW terms. It's Yangian invariant. But you can triangulate it another way, and it's manifestly local. Okay? And it gives you a new formula for the NMHV tree amplitude. This is a venerable old object, and it's really a new formula for it. Okay? And it's completely local. The other example we understand perfectly is MHV one loop. We understand trivial examples perfectly, but that's a necessary start. So in a specific sense, you here the polytope is the product of two of the Wilson polygons. Okay? So you take a product, you take a volume in an appropriate sense of that product, and that defines the one loop amplitude. Now, if you triangulate this polytope internally, if you write it as a sum of triangles like that, you get an expression that's manifestly local. If you triangulate it externally, you get the BCFW form that's unitary. Okay. So again, we have an invariant object. Two different triangulations make locality and unitarity manifest. All right. So that was it for the review of things up to now. And now I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about the strategy for the next step. So how do we proceed to the amplitude? Mark, in his talk, put a sort of dividing line, said, we're done with the integrand, it's done. Now we have to figure out how to do the integrals. Okay? And there's some truth to that. And in a sense, it's the path of least resistance. Okay? And often following the path of least resistance is a really good idea. So from that attitude, what would you do? You would say, great, okay, maybe there's additional nice structure in the integrand, who cares? We have it. We have it at least for two-loop MHV, this one-term formula. So we have it, so let's go compute it. Okay? So you have to get the integrand somehow. You bring it to local form, because only local form do you know how to treat it in any standard way. You then learn how to integrate these guys. The most straightforward thing you can do is by Feynman parameterization. So you start by Feynman parameterization, you start integrating. Okay? This is actually an extremely fun and interesting and cool thing to do, and we've spent some time learning how to do it. And that's one of the things we could also talk about after the break. There's a beautiful structure just here, just even this so-called path of least resistance. There's an absolutely gorgeous structure emerging for thinking about what these Feynman parameter integrals look like, where the polylogs come from, computing their symbols. There is a machine. In principle, there's an algorithm for extracting the symbol of any two-loop integral. Okay, It's not an art, it's a science. And it's in principle straightforward, although if you talk to Mark Anasio, they'll tell you it's not so straightforward in practice. But anyway, we're still in the middle of developing that. So that's one path, okay? This brings me to a point. The vast majority of these integrals are finite. Okay, that's one big difference also with the standard way of doing things. These are completely infrared finite integrals. The infrared divergence are localized in a small subset of them that you really just deal with very likely at the end. Okay. Oh. No, but when you do the whole point of doing Feynman parameterization is it allows you not to think about that. Okay, you Feynman parameterize, you bring everything to one form, then the I epsilon lets you analytically continue that trivial integral into Euclidean space. Okay? So it's not an issue. I mean, we can talk about it more, but that's not a problem. Okay, anyway, so this is a strategy in this direction. Okay, so and it really seems like these pictures are telling some kind of projective geometry story. The Feynman parameter integrals are really naturally projective integrals. They're integrals over CPN. And when you think about them as integrals over CPN, it's really helpful. And so all these pictures are telling different projective geometry stories. And as I said, there's an algorithm for extracting a symbol from anything. And so you could just try to do it. So that's one strategy. And I suspect, at least in this direction of getting there from the integrand in this form, this will probably lead to results first. So it's a great idea to push it. But there are many reasons, at least for me, to expect that this approach is not morally correct. I mean, it is a little funny, after all, to go all this way, and then at the very end, return to Feynman again. To parameterize and compute, I'll say what I think the point in life of the Feynman parameterization is at the end. But before getting there, I want to mention some, to me, very powerful qualitative clues that we've learned from the integrand already, and which must be important for actually computing the integral, but which are completely lost in this standard way of thinking. So I want to tell you three important qualitative things that we've learned about the integrand. Very important thing one, which is completely unobvious, except from this recursive structure. Really, it's completely, it's one thing that the manifest Yangian invariance just hits you directly in the face with and just immediately tells you, which is not obvious at all otherwise. The integrands are total derivatives. All of these integrands are total derivatives. Totally unobvious, okay? But it's a consequence of the Yangian invariance, and we're putting it in a form where term by term they're Yangian invariant. Okay, the statement of the integrand is a total derivative in any standard expansion, local expansion, box expansion, any expansion, it's not only not obvious, it's wrong. Okay, but it's true for the whole sum. In this way of presenting it, it's true also term by term. It just makes it obvious that it's a total derivative. In other words, the amplitude wants to be zero to the loop momentum variables. All of them. I can describe this in a little more. I'll describe this in a little more detail later. Let me just say it loosely. In other words, saying it another way, if you did the integral on any contour that makes sense, which stays away from any possible singular regions or anything, you'll just get zero, or one. You don't get anything interesting. So, in a specific sense, the amplitude is purely an anomaly. It's only non-vanishing because there's an obstruction to this argument that it's a total derivative. You hit boundaries somewhere when you actually carry out the integration. This is a very qualitative insight that tells you why the integrals are bound to be lower transcendentality functions and what they naively appear to be. You take a one-loop integral, it looks like a four-dimensional integral. We all know the answers are dialogues, right? So why is it a dialogue? Is there a good qualitative understanding we have today for why it's a dialogue? No. You just do it. You do it and it turns out to be a dialogue. But this way of presenting it makes it obvious that it's going to be a dialogue. Okay? So this should be important. This should be an important tool in actually computing the integral. Okay? It's completely lost in the local form. Now, something that I know from conversations with Simone, and perhaps other people are doing, is that looking for these anomalies is also something that can be very naturally done with the Wilson loop. So if the idea is to determine the amplitude purely from at least anomalies of the super-dual conformal generators, that's something you can start with the Wilson loop. I suspect that for the whole general story, we'll have to have anomalies for the whole Yangian. And so it'll be useful to have a formalism where the whole Yangian is manifest, and that's the form that I was telling you about before. Okay, so that's one qualitative insight. This isn't so much an insight, but just an observation. So we know we have to get polylogs. We know these polylogs satisfy incredible identities. You all saw Mark's spectacular, jaw-dropping, 17-page to one-line result. And so this is not garbage, okay? This motivic Galois theory is not garbage. It's doing something. Now, you can just ask about that world. You can just ask, what kinds of objects do they run into? What sorts of things do they see? Okay. The theory of these polylogs and the symbols and all this stuff are deeply connected to Grassmannians. And in fact, Goncharov's most recent understanding of polylogs from 2 years ago involves exactly the same kind of cyclic minor structure that we started seeing that we use in the Grassmannians. It's the first time it showed up for him. Okay. So now, on top of that, that's sort of vague. On top of that, even more strikingly, the whole story of the symbols of polylogs has an incredible recursive structure to it, which is combinatorially identical to BCFW, literally identical. The counting is exactly the same. Catalan numbers, Narayana numbers show up in the combinatorics in exactly the same way. You open up Goncharov's papers on computing symbols, and he has pictures where he has a big symbol, and he splits it into two pieces with a line in the middle. He adds something in between. It looks exactly like a BCFW decomposition, except he's recursively computing a symbol directly. Okay. So that's something that makes it sound we're close to being there in this form where we've made it manifestly, where we made it have that kind of structure. And actually, much more physically and to the point, we know that the symbol also, I mean, it's physics information, is that it gives a list of all the monodromies and cuts of the result. Right? That's the content of the symbol. Well, what is it that we know of in the story that's built around monodromies and cuts? That's built around cuts. It's the BCFW expansion is built around cuts. Okay, or maybe there are other things that will be built around cuts, but it should be built around cuts. What I'm saying is that an understanding of the symbol seems to be want to be built around cuts, not around the local expression, but it seems to be built around cuts. Maybe it's not the BCFW form. Maybe it's some other form, but it should be built around cuts. And again, this is obscure in the local form. There's a final, extremely cool and important, I think, many of us think, hint, which is that there's a completely different organization of what's simple and complicated at the level for amplitudes that's suggested from the understanding we now have of the integrand. Okay, I think certainly if you asked me when I first got into this business, what's hard? These are the axes I would draw: loop order and particle number. And things get harder in that direction, and they get harder in that direction. Okay, that's not true for planar n equals 4 super UMLs. The axes n is irrelevant. The axes are k and l. Okay, and it's equal amounts of hardness on these lines. So NMHV tree level, MHV one loop are exactly the same thing. N squared MHV tree, NMHV one loop, MHV two loop are the same thing, and so on. This is the organization in that direction. Okay. Now, this is totally obvious from BCFW recursion. To get the MHV two loop amplitude, we begin with the N squared MHV tree, and then we lose information from it. We lose information from it to get all the way down to the two loop MHV amplitude. In fact, the sort of monster object is sitting up there at tree level. And then we do removing manipulations to it to get down to a two loop MHV. Okay. This is an and it's also obvious in the Wilson loop. It's also a key, very, very important feature of the Wilson loop picture. So this is a very qualitative insight that's completely not obvious. That must play a role in the understanding of how to carry out the integrals. Okay. All right. So I'm really on time. That's amazing. So let me tell you what my hunch and hope is for what the ultimate picture might end up looking. Which is that there is I used P already, so I'll call it P maybe for polytope. Okay, that there is some picture in the middle, some object, which sort of generalizes what we've seen already in the most trivial cases. And one representation of it will lead to the integrand, perhaps in BCFW form, perhaps not, but it'll be some form. I mean, I suspect it'll probably be the BCFW form, but maybe there'll be something else, which is much more connected to unitarity. I erased some things here. So this is a sort of unitarity direction. Okay? And that data should allow us to just purely combinatorially read off the symbol. Okay? So we don't actually touch an integral ever. I mean, it's the hope, but the information is all sitting there is just completely combinatorial data. Even better, even more exciting, would be something where if you wanted, you could skip the integrand altogether and just purely, directly, recursively build the symbol. Okay? So that's one, and that's what I think the sort of morally correct way of getting at least the symbol of the answer will be. And again, after tea, I will tell you the thoughts we have in that direction. And there will be some other representation that is manifestly local. Okay. Now, I started this part of the discussion by saying, where is this local form coming from? These are incredible. These local forms are incredible and simple and beautiful. Where are they coming from? Well, okay, so conjecturally they're coming from something like this that we triangulate in two different ways. But now I've gone through a whole song and dance to tell you that while what you thought you should do is to take this thing and then Feynman parametrize and integrate to get to the symbol, which you can do and we can talk about, but that's not what you should do. Okay? So what are these things good for? What's the point in life of these local integrands? I think the idea is that if you do the straightforward thing of Feynman parametrizing and doing all the standard things, this is not good for computing the answer, but it's good for revealing the connection to ADS. Okay? And this is something that we've seen hints for already, and we're seeing sharper hints for recently, and is something we can also talk about after tea. So anyway, some or all of this could be wrong, but it's almost certainly not the direction that will lead to the two-loop MHV answer next month, which is, I think, the next concrete result that we should all hope to get in the not-too-distant future. The symbol, at least for all two-loop MHV amplitudes, is on the chopping block, and someone should get it soon. But I do hope that eventually the picture will be more like this. And I should say that there's no sharp distinction here between integrand, integral, answer, you know, that there's one much, much more unified structure, which makes a heck of a lot of sense given all the other vague things I was telling you about connecting the right ways of thinking about polylogs and their combinatorial structure and so on. Okay? So it's not like there's the integrand, sharp dividing line, and you start all over and think about new ways of getting the... All right, so that's it. Thanks.